We're fortunate in having with us in this area today Don Deffenbaugh. I first began hearing of Don Deffenbaugh through an old Freed Hardeman roommate of mine, Walter Buchanan, who sang his praises as an excellent preacher, a good Bible student, a great preacher, and I respect Walter's feelings and sentiments about him. We're delighted he has come. He is married to Mary E. Cummins. They've been married now for, 41 years. That's a long time to put up with you, Don. And they have a wonderful Christian family. Children are faithful. They have 12 grandchildren. He has preached, I know he preached for 28 years in Neosho, Missouri, before that in Cassville, Missouri, in the southwestern part of the state. And in 1996, he moved to Joplin to preach. And I recommend to you highly, in particular, his book on the discipling movement among churches of Christ. I used it this past semester in teaching on cults in a course here at the university. He also has written one on Pentecostalism that I just asked him to send me a copy of. And then he says down here last that he wrote a book, biography, on Uncle Roo, an early preacher. Well, I want you to know he's not that early because I heard him when I was a boy. So that makes him real early, I guess so. But we're glad that Don is here to speak with us today. I think you'll really enjoy this. If you don't know much about Samuel Rogers, you need to learn about him. Here's your chance.
You have to understand the peculiar position I occupy on this program. First of all, it's right after dinner. Secondly, it follows Tom Holland, and he is a great preacher and speaker. Thirdly, I have the humbling experience of speaking to many great men and women. I think we make a mistake when we wait for people to die to say that they're great. There are great men and women in our midst, and many of them are here today, and it's a humbling experience for me to be able to speak to you on this subject. And then there is my subject, a great man in his own right that will cause you to be humble as you study his life. I have long believed that we need to praise the bridge that carries us over. I have no use whatsoever for those people who make light of the men who've gone before. Brethren, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the men and women who fought the battles ahead of us, who provided the church buildings where we preach, who laid the groundwork and established congregations, did so many great things. And some of us, especially those who criticize them, are not even capable of holding the candle by which they would have studied. Praise the bridge that carries you over. Samuel Rogers was, in every sense of the word, a man. He was a man who lived for many years, dying in his 88th year. But he was also a man whose years were full. He was a man who was short of stature, being 5'9" tall, and he weighed around 160 to 170 pounds all of his life, yet he was a man who stood tall in the arena of manliness, and he was a spiritual giant. He was a man of God, and at the same time, he was a man of the earth. And this lecture is going to have flavors of both. Being a man of God and a man of the earth, because that is Samuel Rogers. His character and strength was formed by his early life on the American frontier. And this helped him to become a very strong man of God. He was a man who grew up out on the edge of civilization. He fought in the War of 1812, and after one of the battles was over in which he fought, he counted the holes in his clothing, and there were 7 that had been made by the enemy's balls. He trapped, he hunted, he carried a trusted flintlock rifle, he fished, and he knew how to get along in the forest, in the hills, in the prairies. And he knew how to live off the land and get by on little or nothing. But he was a man of deep religious convictions. At first, he was influenced by Barton W. Stone and the New Lights, and later, the teaching of Alexander Campbell. He was a man who was willing to follow the truth wherever it led him. He was a preacher man. who traveled into at least 8 states, and on some occasions finding himself 500 miles away from home in a wilderness and on horseback and by himself. He was a man of little education. Having 3 months of education, he thought his teacher taught him everything his teacher knew. But he continued his education by carrying books in his saddlebags, and as opportunity presented itself, he continued on. Samuel Rogers was a great man with great women in his life, not as Flavel Nichols loves to say, 2 great women in his life, his wife and a surprise mother-in-law. His mother, first of all, who dared to carry a Bible into the land of Catholicism, Upper Louisiana, New Spain, Missouri, against the advice of her husband, because those Catholic priests were there and would frown on a Bible in their land. But she was determined to rear her children by the Bible. And the second great woman in his life was a wife who encouraged him to preach the gospel at all times, even though most of the time it placed a greater burden upon her and the family. I'm here to tell you today that Samuel Rogers was a man in every respect of the word. But you know, we're a long ways ahead of ourselves. Let's drop back and begin at the beginning. He was born in Charlotte County, Virginia, on November the 6th in 1789 to Ezekiel and Rebecca Rogers. His grandfather had come from England and settled in Bedford County, Virginia, in the middle of the 18th century. His grandfather went back to England and was lost at sea, and it wasn't long until his grandmother died of sorrow. At the age of 15, then, his father enlisted under Colonel Washington and was at the surrender of Cornwallis. His father married Rebecca, who was a member of the Church of England, but early on took her stand with the Methodist, and she had Samuel christened by Bishop Asbury. His father decided that they would move from Virginia to Kentucky. They went through the Cumberland Gap, and it was a wilderness. The father would lead the way with his trusty flintlock. Mother would be aboard of the horse. And on the back of the horse, there would be a sack on either side, somewhat like saddlebags. On this side, there would be the kitchenware. And on this side, there would be a small bedroll and perhaps a small child whose head just stuck up over the edge, so he could breathe. And he said it was somewhat in this manner that we made our way through the Cumberland Gap to the wilderness of Kentucky. They settled on Stoner Creek in Clark County. His dad built a log cabin in the deep forest. He said breakfast consisted of hot or cold milk according to your choice and bread, and supper of mush and milk in a pewter dish with pewter spoon while sitting on a floor or a three-legged stool. There weren't any schools nearby, he said, until 1799. And those settlers were satisfied if they had enough money to buy their salt, to buy their leather, and to pay their taxes. And he said when there wasn't enough money for salt, they used hickory ashes. And when there wasn't money to buy leather, they made buckskin moccasins. But they had to have money to pay their taxes. Those were rough and tumble days on the Kentucky frontier, and Samuel Rogers was a part of it. Then a pamphlet fell into the hands of his father, extolling the virtues of Upper Louisiana, New Spain, or Missouri. That was in 1799. They would give 640 acres to every bona fide settler who would go there. So his daddy went. He went with a neighbor, They came to Payne Court. You don't recognize that name, but you would recognize that place if I called it by St. Louis, a small settlement in those days. There's a fellow who lived there just outside of town who liked his horse. He said, "I'll give you 150 acres for your horse." His daddy turned it down, and Samuel said later on that became the area for some of the finest business buildings in all of St. Louis. He purchased 600 acres in one place and then made his settlement in another place and went back home, and he got some cattle, went back up there and sold them. That got him enough money to pay for the farm and to pay for their move. And so in September of 1801, the family left, and Samuel was the oldest child. And he walked, and he carried the rifle, and drove the cattle. This was the time when his father advised his mother to leave the Bible at home, because that land was under the control of the Catholic Church. But she refused and sewed it in a feather bed. She just couldn't think about rearing her children without the influence of the Bible. They lived in a tent along the way, and they would build a big fire in front of the tent. That gave them comfort and light and a way to cook their meals, and they lived off of venison and off of buffalo, and took 4 weeks to make the journey to their new home. And they were quite happy till 1804. Thomas Jefferson made, as the President of the United States, the most famous land purchase that was ever made, Louisiana Purchase. And so Lewis and Clark was sent to explore it. And they wintered right near where Samuel Rogers and his family lived. They made that trip, and because it was successful, it created an interest in that land, and people began moving in and settling, and there was talk of schools and preachers. You see, they hadn't had any up to this time. It was becoming too settled, so Daddy said, "We gotta leave." And they went back to Kentucky. That was in the fall of 1809. In 1810, his father was murdered, and he spent that entire year trying to find the murderer of his father unsuccessfully. But a very important event was about to take place in his life. January the 14th, 1812, he married Elizabeth Irvin. And he said, "In regard to that, to this fact, I owe all that I am under God and all that I hope to be." His wife was responsible for all of the interest that he had in religion. You see, what had happened is that her family had lived over on Cane Ridge, and Barton W. Stone was preaching over there and calling people back to the Bible as the only safe and infallible guide in matters of religion. And they believed that and obeyed it. And that influence was brought into the life of Samuel Rogers. And so he was baptized shortly before his marriage to Elizabeth. In the memoirs of Campbell that was written by Robert Richardson, he made the observation that he was immersed in Hingston Creek by Stone. Well, then because his father had volunteered for the service, he thought he ought to volunteer for the service when the War of 1812 broke out. 1,200 Kentuckians started marching north. They came to Fort Meigs. It had been established on the south side of the river that flows out of Lake Erie by General Harrison. There were 1,000 British troops there and 1,200 Indians. And that fort was under attack. And here came those Kentuckians. And Colonel Dudley was commissioned to go across the river and spike the cannon of the English. This they did. But Dudley fell into a trap and was killed. Now Samuel Rogers remembers there being 700 men. History books say there were 800 men. And only 150 of them returned. And Samuel Rogers had the responsibility of the burial detail. Men had been scalped, dismembered, and otherwise abused. And then he fell into the battle, after which he counted the holes made in his clothes, and the total coming to 7. That's how close he came to death. But he came down with a fever, and finally, in 1813, made his way back home. He worked as a recruiter around home, went to Detroit, and there he was dismissed from the service. He said, during the war, there was little interest in religion, and this affected me. He said, I'd forgotten my first love and turned back to my old sinful ways. But there were spiritual influences that were to come into his life. Reuben Dooley had come to Old Concord, and there he was preaching back to the Bible. And now, Samuel Rogers devoted himself to calling sinners to repentance. His early work as a preacher of the gospel was done in making trips. He said it was invariably associated with forsaking all and taking a journey. He said we didn't look for salary. We didn't look for passage or anything of this kind. We went without purse or scrip and often without our meals because we had nothing to buy with. And we had to swim rivers because we had no money to pay the ferryman. Now at this point in his life, the main influence was Barton W. Stone. And hence, they maintained the mourner's bench. And they were more emotional in their approach. In looking back on that day, he realized that they knew how to make sinners feel, but they didn't know what to tell them to do. They didn't know that there were gospel commands to be obeyed. And he heard Alexander Campbell in 1825, and he said, it was my privilege to hear him in a discourse of 2 hours' length, and I regretted that he could not continue for 2 hours more. I believe the whole audience would have listened patiently until sunset. As he spoke, cloud after cloud rolled away from my mind, letting in upon my soul light and joy and hope that no tongue can express. After a sermon, I was invited to accompany him to the house of Brother Jacob Strickle, where it was my good fortune to have a free and full conversation with him, which gave me more light and afforded me more comfort than any conversation I'd ever enjoyed. The evening was spent chiefly in asking and answering questions. At the close of this protracted interview, I felt that my fondest desire was satisfied, that my most sanguine hopes in reference to this meeting had been more than realized. He didn't know all of the truth at this point in his life, but I tell you, they were on the right track. They were calling people back to the Bible. Sometime after that, he moved to Clinton County, Ohio. He had worked in Ohio, and he saw the need for a full-time preacher in that area, so he went up and built a log cabin in which their first son was born. They gathered a group of Christians, and they met in a schoolhouse, and he was ordained then. In his autobiography, he says he was ordained by Worley and Dooley, but when he wrote, apparently to Robert Richardson, when he was fixing the memoirs of Campbell, he said he was ordained by Stone at Cane Ridge. It doesn't matter. Now he felt free to baptize. And this frontiersman on the very edge of civilization baptized more than 7,000 people, calling them back to the Bible and establishing congregations built on that same foundation. They met in cabins and barns and in woods, and they sat on logs as the weather permitted. They built their first building, seeing the need. Samuel Rogers was given the opportunity to name that building, and he called it Antioch for a reason. The disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. And then it was from this place that his great evangelistic meetings began. These were made mostly into Missouri. I don't know whether it was accident or on purpose that a Missouri preacher would come and talk about the influence of a man in the state of Missouri or not. It doesn't matter to me. I'm happy for the privilege. He left with James Hughes. He said, "We made ready for the journey and set out, prepared to take soldiers' fare on the route, as most of the country through which we were to pass was yet a wilderness." We can't imagine that. We don't know anything about that. And I want you to know, before I get there, 500 miles on this trip one way. No roads, no cars, no budgetel motel. A wilderness, a compass, his flint and steel, and his trusty horse. Two men. They held meetings along the way as they could. He said, "At Ramsey's Creek in Missouri, we reaped a bountiful harvest. We did not receive as much money from first to last as we had spent, and it was from here that his partner turned back." Turned back. So here he is, by himself, with his horse, 500 miles away from home. He tells about that first night. He stopped. He took out his flint and steel. He started his fire. He boiled some water. He made his tea. You see, he was an Englishman by descent. And then he cooked his supper. He got ready to sleep. He took the saddle off of old Paddy. And he used the saddle. He laid down the blanket, I take it, that he was carrying on his saddle to lay on. He put his saddlebags on top of that. And then the blanket on which the saddle had rested. Are you acquainted with horses and horse riding? He covered himself with that. He said, "Long about midnight, the wolves started howling." He said, "I rose up and put more logs on the fire and waited for daylight." So daylight came, and he started out as a beautiful morning. That part of Missouri especially, and even over into the close to the Ozarks, was a rolling prairie in those days, believe it or not. And grass would be 4, 5, 6 feet high. And that's where he was, and he looked up, and there came a fire. What are you to do? He stopped, got off his horse, took his flint and steel, started a fire, let it go. Then he got out in the center of it, and the fire went around him. Is all right. Now, he knew how to get along. Some of us have been dead. Time came for him to go home. 500 miles, freezing weather, and he made it okay. He'd been gone for 3 months. You know what he did when he got back? He went to visit James Hughes to make another arrangement to go back to Missouri. And so this time, they were at the forks of the White River, and they were conducting a meeting, and Elijah Goodwin was baptized. Those of you who are familiar with Restoration history will recognize that name. Now, he didn't baptize Elijah Goodwin himself, but he was there when that happened. They had crossed the Illinois River, and they were getting ready to come into Missouri. And I want to read these words to you. "We traveled on until late at night with no other light than the flashing lightning, which was almost incessant. In the midst of the thunder, lightning, and rain, we at length lost our path. After an anxious search of some time, we succeeded in finding it, and we followed it until we entered a grove. And here we concluded to tie up our horses and wait for morning. We sat upon our saddles." Now, he doesn't say whether they took those saddles off the horse or left it on the horse. But they sat upon their saddles and rested against a large tree while we covered our heads with our blankets to protect us from the mosquitoes which were waiting to devour us. In this condition, we slept a little, not knowing what was ahead of us. Morning found us on the hills overlooking the Mississippi. Following a dim path, we were soon in the bottom at the house of a man named Ross. Here we fed our horses, ate our breakfast, and were ready for new toils. Mr. Ross informed them that they had a long ways to go before they got to the river. They were going to have to go across bayous and streams, and it took all day to get to the side of the river. And he said, when they got there, the ferryman kindly furnished us skins to sleep on and to cover with. And after giving me a cup of strong spicewood tea and other attentions, he committed us to sleep for the night. I slept soundly and perspired freely during the night and was entirely relieved by morning, sleeping on and under skins. He returned home, and he came down with a fever. And you can imagine why he would come down with a fever. He said, my attack was violent, so much so that it spared of my life. Then he went east, preached in eastern Ohio, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. And upon his return home, he went immediately with Daniel Combs on a tour of the Little Sandy. He just got in home, and he was there waiting. He said, let's go. He said, I'm tired. But he went anyway. It was on that trip where they preached at the forks of Brush Creek and ate their last meal for 48 hours. He said, we ate green apples for 2 days and two nights. Now, I don't know what happens to you when you eat green apples, but I know what happens to me. He now devoted time to the churches he had planted around home. He makes another trip into Missouri. In spite of what he considered a call to go to Charlotte County, Virginia. You see, what they were doing in those days was still following their inclinations and feelings. They considered them to be calls from God. And he said, I was troubled about my call. My mind was often in a wretched state. He said, we didn't think about looking in the Bible for our call. He left with three brethren. They got sick. One man went with him. But upon return, he came down with a serious illness due to fatigue and perplexity of mind, still struggling with his call from God. In 1822, he made another trip into Missouri with his brother John. He said, now there wasn't any need for camping out. Folks everywhere. Although they did carry with them jerked beef and cornbread. They were in Dover, Missouri. Because he was a woodsman, he liked during the daytime when opportunity allowed to go strolling through the forest. He had done that this day and he saw several squirrels, so the next day he decided he would take his flintlock with him. So he went. And he sat down on a large grapevine and over there was a squirrel. Head he could barely see. He didn't want to take his eyes off of him. If you've been squirrel hunting, you know exactly what he's talking about. But he heard this noise coming. And finally he had to look. And he said it was a snake. Matter of fact, it was a rattlesnake and it was coming right at me. I took my rifle and shot him. And in describing that rattlesnake, he said, he was monster in size and venerable in age, having 16 rattles. It was in Howard County that he was thrown from his horse. I don't know why this didn't happen more. A lot better rider than I am, apparently. He was in serious condition. His brother was with him. He helped him. They went to this house, and the latest, up-to-datest medical thing was bleeding. So they bled him. And he said he was able to rest some that night, but I was interested in noticing that he said, my brother had to do the preaching on the rest of the journey. After returning, he said, I didn't have enough money left to buy a pair of boots. I wish I had more time. So many things I want to say. I'd like to read this one, though, about preachers' pay. I know preachers will appreciate it. It said, both among our preachers and people, there was a prevalent sense of foolish timidity upon the matter of taking up contributions of money for the ambassador of God, lest the world might conclude that he cared more for the fleece than he did for the flock. The little that we did receive was collected and given to us in a manner so slyly and so secret that the giver often appeared more like a felon than like God's cheerful giver. And we who were the recipients of those small favors were ready to jump out of our boots if anyone should hear the money jingle in our pockets. Well, do I remember how I used to receive those small pittances from my brethren. When a brother or sister, in telling you goodbye, took hold of your hand in a clumsy sort of way. Has this ever happened to you? Probably has to most of us, haven't it? With a hand half shut and half opened, you might look out for a quarter or a few cut ninepences. You may imagine that our hands became very sensitive to those clumsy touches. I've had money slipped into my vest pocket, into my pants pocket, and once I found a piece of money in my sack, which had been deposited there while I was asleep. All this was done that the ministry might not be blamed and for the purpose of keeping that telltale left hand in blissful ignorance of what the right hand had done. Oh, mercy. Well, we got to go to Indiana for sure. Because of hard times, he went to Indiana. He worked at secular work, first of all, but he wasn't satisfied. And he finally moved to Henry County on November the 13th, 1833. And he was neighbor to Joseph Franklin, who had a very famous son, Ben Franklin, the gospel preacher. And during a meeting, Ben Franklin and his brother were baptized. And he pointed out that this was the greatest contribution that he had made to the work of the Lord. He said, in regard to his preaching, I never made a fine sermon in my life. I preached fine sermons, powerful sermons, but they were first preached by Christ and the apostles. What a marvelous statement. Oh, he moved around until he got back to Kentucky. he worked a little while for the Elkhorn congregation in the hills of Kentucky. Here he met William Rogers. Wasn't any kin. William Rogers and his wife had 22 children. He was uneducated. His wife taught him the alphabet, but he became very proficient in the scriptures and a powerful preacher in those mountains. And somebody had asked him a question about the Old Testament scriptures. He went back, those men, mountain men had brought their rifles. He went back and fetched one, brought it up here, and he says, you take that front sight and put it in the back sight and you put it on the object and you're able to kill it. He says the back sight's the Old Testament with its prophecies, types and shadows. The front sight's the New Testament and the object is Christ. And he said, when you put that New Testament rested in the Old Testament, you can see Christ clearly. Oh my. He made another trip back to Missouri. In his 84th year, he left Cynthiana. He arrived in St. Joseph, which is in the northwest part of our state. He considered a long journey for one who was deaf and almost blind. He preached at various places around the state, one or two times at a place. And then after 3 months, he returned home. And he says, this I intended for my last long journey. And certainly it has been the happiest journey of all. His wife Elizabeth, whom he affectionately called Betsy, had died on March the 30th, 1867. Following her death, he spent some time in the home of his youngest daughter in Cynthiana, staying near the spot where Betsy and their youngest son, who died in the Civil War, was buried in the site of the old home place. Later on, he moved to Carlisle to live with his daughter Frances. And June the 23rd, 1877, he passed away in his 88th year of age. And thus Uncle Sam, as he was affectionately called, and Betsy, his sweet Betsy with her lustrous eyes, bright smile, and auburn hair, were once again together. Someday, you and I will be able to sit down by the side of the river under the tree of life, and there let him tell in person of the toils and struggles of the olden times.
It is obvious that Brother Deffenbaugh loves the history of the church and